from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, this is necessary because I got about five email responses to last week's broadcast from, I'll grant you, among the smarter members of the listening audience, all of whom said, "Oh no, Harry, oh no you don't. This isn't the end of the decade. No, don't you do a best of the decade show next week. Don't you dare, because the decade doesn't end for another year because of the thing, because there was no year zero. Don't you fall in with that media crowd now." So, two things. First of all, there will be no best of the decade, no decade in rebuke this week. Not because of that, because it just was too lazy to go dig in the archives. But two, why don't we just solve this once and for all and decide among ourselves, you know, the smart people, that the first decade of the modern era had 9 years. No, there was no year zero, but the first decade had 9 years. It was kooky. It was an anomaly. No one can really explain it. But for the rest of the time now, till we change the calendar, which Chinese will take care of shortly, you know, it works the way most people think it works. Okay, can we agree on that? Can we get together on that in this, the first year of the new year? All right, thank you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, because this is going to be the year of HD radio. Oh, I feel it in my bones. By the way, you do know that there is no HD in HD radio. There's no H and there's no D. It's just, you know, it's HD. Like that new toaster. The HD Radio Alliance, an industry consortium created to promote HD radio, is preparing a fresh wave of publicity in the new year, according to Media Daily News, with radio commercials touting the availability of free HD channels. Many radio stations, it says, are using HD to create niche channels. I shared with you a couple weeks ago what some of those niche channels were. If you want to hear K-Rock from L.A. in San Diego, that's a niche channel, if you don't have the internet. The spots will also emphasize that the content is free because, you know, there's a thing. This is playing to what others have termed monthly fee fatigue among cash-strapped consumers. The first wave of HD campaigns focused on building awareness of the new medium, and that really worked. Subsequent campaigns continued the awareness push, while also promoting consumer electronics retailers. The latest campaign aims to make the consumer proposition easy to understand. Well, what do you mean? Oh, I see. The total number of radio stations broadcasting in so-called HD exceeds 1,800. Just check the number of actual radio stations in the country to see the percentages, ladies and gentlemen. The base of HD radio sets installed in the United States remains fairly small, 1.3 million, up from about 600,000 at the end of 2008. So good luck to the I know this seems, given my attitude, paradoxical, but no, it's investigative. I'm actually getting an HD radio, and I'll let you know. Meantime, what's going on with our friend Pakistan? I know everybody now has discovered Yemen. And we now realize that Guantanamo Bay will not be closed because of fear of the Yemeni within. But back in Pakistan, a letter from the father of the H-bomb, father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, A.Q. Khan, has surfaced in the Washington Post, of all places. North Korea, it says, has constructed a plant to manufacture a gas needed for uranium enrichment. That's according to this previously unpublicized account by A.Q. Khan. He said North Korea may have been enriching uranium on a small scale by 2002 with maybe 3,000 or even more centrifuges. We better do something. And that Pakistan helped the country with vital machinery, drawings, and technical advice for at least 6 years. That's our friend. It's our friend. North Korea's nuclear program is among the world's most opaque. Khan's account could not be independently corroborated. Khan says North Korea built the pilot plant without help. It's included in a narrative that depicts relations between the two countries' scientists as exceptionally close for nearly a decade. Pakistan and North Korea, you figure it out. Khan says, for example, that during a visit to North Korea in 1999, he toured a mountain tunnel. Ooh, there his host showed him boxes containing components of three finished nuclear warheads. His visit occurred 7 years before the country's first detonation, suggesting North Korea's achievements were more advanced than previously known and the country may have more sophisticated weapons or a larger number than earlier estimated. Maybe. Back in Pakistan, he also is on the offensive. A.Q. Khan, father of the bomb. He's asking for the return of his debugging devices, confiscated in 2006. He had been using the equipment to spot the bugging devices installed at his home after he was put under house arrest. Well, you know, that's only, if you're under a house arrest, you might as well have debugging devices. And a U.S. anti-nuclear group regarding the Khan letter says it would be a mistake to accept the scientists' self-serving leaks without proper corroboration, according to a Pakistani newspaper. One report claims the Dutch secret agents are the people who recovered the letters that the A.Q. Khan originally wrote to his daughter. Western media used the information to attack Pakistan, according to this Pakistani newspaper, but it points out none of the reports explained why a nuclear scientist would include such sensitive information in a letter to his wife, while he had ample opportunities to share it with her at home. Well, that's written by somebody who clearly isn't married. Hello, welcome to the show.
Well, the rain falls down without my help. I'm afraid and my lawn gets wet, though I've withheld my consent. When this gray world crumbles like a cake, I'll be hanging from the hoop that I'll never see that recipe again. As I walk, I think about a new way to walk. As I think, I'm using up the time left to think. And this train keeps rolling off the track, trying to act like something else, trying to go where it's been uninvited. It's not my birthday, it's not today. I was less than we could bear, and I'm not the only dust my mother raised. So I'm rattling the bars around this drink tank. Discreetly I should pour through the keyhole or evaporate completely. But there'd be no percentage and there'd be no proof, and the sound upon the roof is only water. And the rain falls down without my help, I'm afraid. And my lawn gets wet, though I've withheld my consent. When this gray world crumbles like a cake, I'll be hanging from the hoop that I'll never see that recipe again. It's not my birthday, it's not today. It's not my birthday, so why do you lunge at me? When the word comes down, never more will be around. Though I wish you were there, I was less than we could bear. And I'm not the only dust my mother raised.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the first Le Show of 2010, whatever decade we're in. And because we're in the post-Christmas 2009 world now, ladies and gentlemen, Tales of Airport Security. Here's a copyrighted feature NPR hasn't filched yet. Two items today. First from Joe. Dear Harry, I was on a music tour that took me to the Philippines. Ooh-ooh. When, as we were leaving the country, we went through the inspection of our carry-on items. All All of the instruments that we carried with us were in ATA flight cases that were checked in as baggage, with the exception of the guitarist's electric guitar, which was in a soft gig bag carrying case, which he carried on board. As his guitar was inspected, he was made to unstring it and discard the strings for fear that he could use them as a garrote. He did so, and we soon boarded the plane with the spare set of guitar strings in the gig bag's pouch, undisturbed. And then there's this from C. Just initial C. It's a C note. Dear Harry, I was flying from Fort Wayne International Airport, he puts it in quotes, the international part, to Las Vegas on December 29th, 4 days after the Northwest debacle in Detroit. When I checked my bag at the ticket counter, I was never asked for ID. Then, as I waited with family near the security checkpoint, I noticed that the security guard manning the entrance, the one who checks tickets and IDs, had left the station vacant. Six passengers walked past the unmanned desk, put their stuff on the X-ray belt, and walked onto their gates without having their ID checked. Had I decided to go to the gate at that time, I could have gotten on the plane in Fort Wayne and flown to Las Vegas, never having had my ID checked. Blech. It's an editorial addendum from C. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And there's news of the digital wonderland as well. This from Jake, Michael. Harry, I use digital airwave TV, or whatever you call it. I think he means over the air. I know cable has so screwed up our understanding of the world we live in. It's broadcast is what he means. Broadcast television. He continues. Although I am 45 minutes away from Philadelphia, I can only get 2/3 of the stations with my digital antenna, which I have to hang in the closet by the front door of my ground floor condo. Fortunately, I get PBS and Fox, so I can watch Antiques Roadshow and the Eagles games, which is all I need. You don't need this. Everything was going fine until last week when I hosted a holiday party and the signal broke up again. What was the cause? I had hung a strand of Christmas lights inside my living room. Once I took the lights down, everything was okay. I'm thinking this could be used as the basis for Tim Allen's next Christmas movie. Mm-hmm. It's a robust new medium we've bought ourselves into, isn't it? In the digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen, because it is a digital wonderland. Speaking of aviation, as we were a moment ago, though, this from Bloomberg News. In May 2009, the FAA found that Gulfstream International Airlines, which operates many continental flights, had violated multiple regulations. It proposed a $1.3 million fine. Gulfstream is appealing the penalty. FAA inspectors found that Gulfstream put planes in the air even after the company's own staff had repeatedly reported malfunctions in the aircraft. Gulfstream crews documented 7 times in a month that one turboprop had faulty landing gear. Eventually, that plane touched down without wheels under its nose. That's nothing new. I don't have wheels under my nose. I land fine. Gulfstream also scheduled crew members to work more hours than allowed, according to the FAA, and the airline had installed on planes automotive parts not certified by the FAA for use in airplanes. Hey, an oil filter is an oil filter. What do you want? They were trying to force pilots to fly airplanes that weren't in any condition to fly, says a pilot who used to fly for Gulfstream. They did everything to cut costs, and they seemed to be crossing a line to where it was not safe. These concerns resonate across the U.S., says Bloomberg News, for millions of people who fly regional airlines every year. Companies like Gulfstream run the fleets that Delta, United, Continental, and most other majors use for commuter flights. That is, those are the planes where probably your carry-on bag isn't small enough to go overhead and you have to check it at the gate. Those airlines. Now, they're irritating enough just for that, but then there's this. Continental Flight 3407, operated by Colgan Air, crashed in icy weather almost a year ago outside of Buffalo, New York. The plane's captain had been trained by Gulfstream, which has an aviation school known as Gulfstream Academy. The pilot and his first officer may have erred in responding to a stall warning by pulling up the nose of the plane rather than pointing it down to increase speed, according to the National Transportation Safety Board. Gulfstream also trained the co-pilot on the last fatal commercial airline flight before that crash, a Delta commuter plane operated by Calm Air, which used the wrong runway in Lexington, Kentucky. Gulfstream also previously employed the two pilots who crashed a Pinnacle Airlines plane with no passengers after deciding to fly at their jet's maximum altitude to have fun. They crashed and died in Jefferson City, Missouri. The first officer attended Gulfstream Academy. Gulfstream Chief Executive Officer David Hackett says it's a coincidence the crashes were piloted by graduates from the company's academy. I don't know, sounds like a commercial to me. Pilots for regionals are often less experienced than those who fly for the majors and work more grueling schedules. Regional airlines handled more than 158 million passengers in 2008. Regional flights usually bear the names of their major airline partners. That leaves many passengers unaware that the planes they fly on and the pilots who command them may not match the safety standards of the airline whose name they see on the tickets. The last five fatal crashes of commercial passenger carriers in the U.S. involved regional airlines. Major airlines contract out to regionals to lower their expenses by getting around union agreements, says the president of the Airline Pilots Association, a union. The American public is only just starting to wake up to that, he says. What they're buying is the lowest-cost operation that's available. Pilots, mechanics, and crew schedulers say Gulfstream doesn't want to hear complaints about safety. Pilots say Gulfstream has an unhealthy relationship between its airline and its flight school. Its training program guarantees students time as a first officer, the number two position in the cockpit, flying passengers for its own airline, Gulfstream says on its website. We offer the fastest possible transition to the right seat of a commercial airliner. For $32,000, students get more than 500 hours of training. That means student pilots are paying Gulfstream for the privilege of flying as first officers. Because of that 522 hours of training, 250 are flying as a first officer for Gulfstream. We'll see you in the air, won't you? That puts it all, too much perspective, don't you think? And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Lake Chad was bigger than Israel less than 50 years ago. Today, its surface area is less than a tenth of its earlier size. Mid forecast, the lake could disappear altogether within 20 years. Climate change and overuse have put one of Africa's mightiest lakes in mortal danger, and the lives of the 30 million people who depend on its waters is hanging by a thread as a result. Lake Chad has experienced shrinkage. Four countries, Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and Nigeria, and four others, those first four border Lake Chad, four others, Central African Republic, Algeria, Sudan, and Libya, share the lake's hydrological basin. Lake Chad has experienced shrinkage, says Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. I want to warn the world about this imminent disaster, he says. All right, thank you, Muammar. Villages that used to be thriving lakeside ports are now stranded miles from the water and have been swallowed by the advancing Sahara Desert. Fishers and farmers are struggling to survive. Biodiversity, too, has been hit by the lakes. No real evidence here why it's happening, though, so we'll take that as a provisional news of the warm. But now, coral reef fish can undergo a personality change in warmer water, according to an intriguing new study suggesting that climate change may make some species more aggressive. As evidence, I would cite Ari Emanuel. Experiments with two species of young damselfish on Australia's Great Barrier Reef have shown for the first time that some reef fish are either consistently timid or consistently bold, and that these individual differences are more marked as water temperatures rise, according to Science Daily. A slight lift of just 1 or 2 degrees may have only a small effect on some fish, but the behavior of others can be transformed, leading them to become up to 30 times more active and aggressive. The idea that fish have personalities may seem surprising at first. Hey, I'm still getting used to the fact that people do. So sue me. But now we know that personality is common in animal populations, and that this phenomenon may have far-reaching implications for understanding how animals respond to ecological and environmental challenges, says Dr. Peter Biro of the University of New South Wales School of Biological Earth and Environmental Sciences, who led the study. Our results also suggest that temperature variations are much more significant than we thought in the way they affect the behaviors of individual animals. Individual variations in activity and boldness can affect food acquisition, encounter rates with predators, and even the likelihood of an individual being captured by harvesting gear. We observed that most of the individuals in our experiments were very responsive to changes in temperature, dramatically increasing their levels of activity, boldness, and aggressiveness as a function of increases of only a few degrees of temperature. Now, fish do experience such temperature fluctuations during the course of a normal day, but they all became more active when the water was warmed in a tank where the fish were studied, some becoming up to 30 times more active, bold, and aggressive. So, just be warned, ladies and gentlemen, the next salmon you eat may bite back. News of the warm. Ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Well, I got a really bad feeling about who's. It's like trying to stand up. You've been hit by a gust of wind. I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. Again. A really bad feeling, man. It's too hard to sort out. It's too hard to discuss. Well, I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's a time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way. Back to Blighty again. What I wouldn't give for a little bit of filthy weather. Sometimes what I wouldn't give for a late ride in a black cab or a double decker. Got a really bad feeling, man. Trying to stand up, and you've been hit by a gust of wind. Well, so many things I don't really understand. It's like trying to be a woman. It's like trying to be a good man. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season. And I'm on my way back to Blighty again. I'm yeah, yeah.
This is Le Show, and now, news from outside the bubble. On the BBC Saturday, former British Prime Minister John Major, conservative, ladies and gentlemen, conservative, now says he's beginning to have doubts about the whole Iraq war thing based on the ongoing inquiry that's revealing there were doubts inside the British government over the existence of weapons of mass destruction before the war began. He says, when I was Prime Minister during the Gulf War, when I spoke to the nation, I knew what I was saying was true, and I said less than I knew. I assumed the same about Tony Blair. Now he wonders whether the British cabinet was made aware that there were doubts about the existence of weapons of mass destruction. And he says, the fact that Saddam was a bad man is an absolutely unacceptable rationale for toppling him. He says, the world is full of bad men leading countries. We don't topple them. A conservative, John Major. From the Times of London, the United Kingdom will move quickly to enhance airport security after the failed Christmas Day airliner attack over Detroit, according to current Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who called that attack a, quote, wake-up call, unquote. He did not clarify as to why and who was sleeping and why. From the McClatchy newspapers, as the U.S. and its allies try to overcome logistical hurdles and rush some 40,000 more troops to Afghanistan this year, intelligence officials are warning that the Taliban-led insurgency is expanding and that, quote, time is running out for the U.S.-led coalition to prove that its strategy can succeed. The Taliban have created a shadow government in waiting, complete with cabinet ministers that could assume power if the Karzai government fails, says a senior coalition intelligence official in Kabul, speaking on condition of anonymity. The northern region has experienced a return by the Taliban, and that poses serious security, logistical, and political problems for the coalition and Karzai's government. The northern region is under the command of the German forces, but they and other European contingents are, you know, European. The Taliban now threaten the northern supply route that the coalition established to supplement the vulnerable routes that run through Pakistan. The Taliban in northern Afghanistan are sheltering among and recruiting from large communities of Pashtuns, settlers transplanted from the south in the early 20th century, fueling tensions with the Uzbeks and Tajiks who dominate the region. At the same time, though, Uzbeks, Tajiks, Chechens, and Arabs linked to al-Qaeda have moved into northern Afghanistan, with the Taliban seeking to carry their jihad to the former Soviet republics of Central Asia and alarming Russia. As the Taliban have expanded their reach, they've also grown more formidable militarily by developing bigger and more effective IEDs. Not what you think. Insurgents have mounted 7,000 IED attacks so far in 2009. Well, the figures are in, compared with 81 in 2003. And as McClatchy reported earlier, the homemade bombs have even destroyed some mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, those MRAPs, the most heavily armored U.S. troop transports. So that sounds good. That looks good for us. And a female British soldier is accused of sexually humiliating and abusing prisoners in Iraq in a series of claims about British troops in Basra. This is just for you to kind of conjure up another group of bad apples doing exactly the same thing. Isn't that wild how that could happen? Five former detainees have made specific allegations against a female interrogator they knew as Katie. 14 new cases brought against a secretive British Army interrogation unit bring to a total of 40 the pending British court cases by former Iraqi detainees. Sexual abuse was routinely practiced by the Joint Forward Intelligence Team, the JFIT, between 2003-2007, it's claimed. This is a story from the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch. The unit ran the Divisional Temporary Detention Facility, the DTDF, near Basra. Among the allegations is at least one case of male rape. Interrogators are also accused, of course, of practices outlawed in Britain, including threats and actual violence, the use of stress positions, sleep deprivation, exposure to heat and cold, hooding, and threats to rape and murder detainees' families. It's like those guys, it's like that improv thing that happened in Abu Ghraib. More improv. If you went to like three improv clubs and saw the same bit, wouldn't you get suspicious after a while? Wouldn't you think that they were like subscribing to a service of some sort? The Ministry of Defense spokesman says all the allegations are being or would be investigated. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. It is true. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of the Olympiad. South Korean President Lee Myung-bak has decided to pardon convicted former Samsung Group chairman Lee Kun-hee. Why the pardon? To give Lee a free hand to work for South Korea's bid to host the 2018 Winter Olympics. In August, a court sentenced him to a suspended three-year prison term and a fine of $132 million. Sorry, about $85 million for tax evasion and breach of duty, wrapping up years of litigation over a series of bonds issued by the company aimed at transferring management control over Samsung to his only son, Lee Jae-young. The 67-year-old Lee had run Samsung before he resigned in April 2008 in the wake of the scandal. The presidential pardon is aimed to boost Korea's chance to host the Winter Olympics after two unsuccessful bids. Yeah, this should do it. You got my vote. President Lee said he made the decision for the sake of the national interest following the repeated requests from sports circles and businesses. And Gangwon Province, where the would-be Olympic city is located. Business groups welcome the decision. Corporate lobbies recently requested a presidential clemency for 78 business executives, but only Lee received a pardon. Well, because only he can help the Olympics, I guess. A one-person pardon had only been conducted eight times previously in South Korea in history, largely for former officials and politicians. Well, that seems fair. Pardoning the disgraced for the athletes of the world. The Olympics. It's a movement, and everyone needs one.
Around the roses, she shone as high as the gold-plated garden tools, sunglasses, and it's all the rage. Stay low to the ground, or they'll sniff you out. You never know what you will find. When you go out of the blackness into the great big sky, super collider shooting inside your mind.
Again in Times Square, New York City. And for those of you who've just turned in, I'm still Ryan Seacrest. Some great entertainment still coming up. Right now with us to explain once again this brand new celebration, this brand new occasion, is Dominique Petropiano, chairman of the New York Tourism Marketing Corporation. Dominique,
yeah.
You got a great day here in Times Square.
Yeah.
Tell us all about it one more time.
Thanks, Ryan. Very simply, this is the very first of what we think will be the first annual New York 3, NY3 celebrations here in the front yard of the world. NY3, very simply, is two things. First, it's New York, New York, New Year's. There you go with the NY3.
NY3.
And then it's a celebration on the 3rd of January. which is today.
Dominic, I'm sure many of our viewers who are tuning in expecting to see college hoops or pro bowling or something else are wondering, why today? Why January the 3rd? Aren't we well into the new year by now?
Yes, to all of your questions, Ryan. Why today? We've got almost 1 million tourists who came into the center of the world for New Year's Eve festivities. Every year, they look around on New Year's Day and they say to themselves, now what? This is the answer to that, a way to make a weekend of it and enjoy even more of the front porch of the world. And since we have to raise the ball back up to the top of One Times Square at some point during the year after it drops, why not make a party out of it and invite a few hundred thousand of our best friends?
It's exciting, Dominic. It's exciting to be part of it and sharing some of the excitement right now is Mr. Sean Puffy Combs. Sean, I see your face about 50 stories high looking down on us from a big vodka billboard. Congratulations on that.
Thanks, Ryan. That's what it's all about. But it's not Sean, it's not Puffy, it's not Combs anymore. It's a new year, Ryan, and I got myself a new name.
I don't want to say that's an annual event, but it sure is something we look forward to because it means new PR releases and new video press kits.
Thank you.
So what's it going to be this year? I know you vetoed some time ago the idea that was suggested on our website of poop duty.
Ryan, that stuff's all behind me, as you say. I'm now representing one of the great vodkas of the world, many other elite products. I needed a name to match that particular persona, you know? And we're better to make this announcement than in the elite products capital of the world.
No, you're right about that.
So as of today, I'm going to be known worldwide as Seanus Puffingham Combs-Overton.
Wow, that sounds almost British.
Yeah, that's the idea. Almost British. Mm-hmm. You know, classic, like the products I represent and the ones I'll be representing later this year.
Oh, any advance previews?
No, just whoever sparks to the new name.
Mm-hmm.
Letters are the initials of the name, S.P.C. That makes a cool logo. I think my corporate brother's going to be down with that.
Hey, speaking of which, haven't you become involved in a new kind of public service venture?
Yes, I have. It's a kind of spiritual outreach organization.
Oh.
It's called Down With People. We're just working out a tax thing, but it's huge. Just, you know, even conceptually.
Seanus Puffingham Combs-Overton.
That's good.
Well, read it right off the card here. Thanks for helping to make this NY3 the best one ever so far.
My good.
Dick, can it get more exciting than this?
I don't know how, Ryan. Except to say we got a wonderful performer whose new album is coming out a week from now. And she's here to do her latest hit.
That is so right, Dick. Please welcome to the street stage of the world, Miss Jennifer Lopez.
Becoming my thing, and my thing is coming out of hiding, 'cause it knows your thing is really something, and that something has got me thinking, that's my thing, it's nothing but a new thing, and now I got to you thing, 'cause when you do the thing you do, my thing's got a thing for you.
Thing on twice much fun as speaking in Klingon. Thing is, I think about the thing, my bob, the thing of the jig, play is the thing I play.
The main thing is that it's not the same thing. That's why I call out your name, thing. You know, I love the thing that your thing gives me. In the thing right next to my kidney. Was doing my own thing, but now I feel as young as Jeezy. Your thing is dark and I am sneezy. Don't you know that your thing is becoming my thing, and my thing is coming out hiding, 'cause it knows your thing is really something.
You know, Ryan, I can't remember when I heard a tune that catchy.
Mm-hmm.
So easy to look at that Buick. What a celebration. And there's so much more to come.
Not only that, Dick, there's so much more to come.
I head now.
Coming up, the first ever climax of NY3, the raising of the ball to the top of number one Times Square, just moments away here on NY Rockin' 3, live from the Billboard of the World.
Eu sei que houve um romance tempos atrás, que ela sofreu por amar demais. Depois a chama apagou pra nunca mais. Sei dos desencantos que ela penou pra que aprendesse ela.
Now,
he's not a general,
he commands no troops,
he's not an inspector,
he peeks at no stoops,
he's an
inspector general. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. The infighting among the federal officials in charge of the Savannah River site, a federally owned nuclear site in South Carolina that was one of the country's biggest winners of stimulus money, is so severe, that infighting, that it threatens to undermine public confidence in their work, according to the Department of Energy's Inspector General. He conducted a wide-ranging inquiry into a host of accusations. I'll be your host of accusations for tonight, that have been swirling ever since relations between the department officials who work at the site and those who oversee them from Washington broke down last summer. The resulting report, inconclusive about many of the specific accusations, but highlighted, quote, an unusual level of distrust and acrimony, unquote, among officials in charge of the highly contaminated nuclear site. How did that happen? It's clean, safe, cheap. The Savannah River site, owned by the federal government and operated by five private contractors, received $1.6 billion to speed up efforts to clean the toxic legacy from the years when it produced 40% of the plutonium for our nuclear weapons stockpile. It was during the Cold War. You get it. The stimulus award and the pressure to spend it quickly exacerbated tensions between the federal officials based at Savannah River and those in the Environmental Management Office in Washington who oversee their work. Things got so bad, one federal official accused another of threatening to shoot him. The report warned that the bitter atmosphere could undermine public confidence in the site. I don't think that's possible. And made several recommendations, including that the Department of Energy take prompt action to, quote, facilitate conflict resolution between officials at the site and at headquarters. Okay, how do you guys at the site feel right now? Yeah, let's open up about that. The department planned to put in place the Inspector General's recommendation, according to an Undersecretary of Energy. That doesn't mean she doesn't have enough energy now. All right, that's the news of Inspector General, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Moving quickly to the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Republican Governor Jim Gibbons of Nevada has fired his campaign manager for describing the role of a first lady as, quote, window dressing, leaving him with a staff of only volunteers 6 months before the primary. Robert Ulmer, a former ski resort executive, was Gibbons' only paid campaign staff member. After Gibbons reached a divorce settlement this week with the first lady, Dawn, Ulmer said the state wouldn't suffer from having the position vacant. Quote, essentially any first lady is to a large extent window dressing, just showing up for public events, he told the Reno Gazette Journal. Gibbons immediately distanced himself from the remarks. On Wednesday, he apologized for the comments before condemning them and firing Ulmer. Dawn Gibbons spent 3 years as a busy first lady of Nevada, representing the state at various functions and spearheading initiatives to combat methamphetamine abuse and fund autism treatment. In the wake of public outcry against the Transportation Security Administration for serving civil subpoenas on two bloggers, the government agency has canceled the legal action and apologized for the strong-arm tactics agents used. These were the bloggers who were among many who put the TSA's manual online. The document was not classified. Senegal's Muslim president Abdoulaye Wade has apologized for a controversial... I know, I shouldn't be laughing at my own inability to pronounce his name. Has apologized for a controversial remark about Christianity that prompted street demonstrations in Dakar. The president's son issued the apology, Karim Wade, who is a government official. Minister of State of... How did he get that job? Wow. He said the president cares about all of Senegal's religious communities, including Christians. Mr. Wade's offending comment earlier this week appeared to be an attempt to deflect criticism by Muslim religious leaders and others over a massive monument he commissioned. The president argued that no one disparages Christians for, in his words, quote, praying to someone who is not God, unquote. The leader of Senegal's Roman Catholic community said the president's conduct was scandalous and intolerable and said he owes his nation a public apology. Cleric had said Mr. Wade had questioned the religious beliefs of his fellow Senegalese citizens and subjected them to ridicule. The project that sparked the dispute, Wade's Monument of the African Renaissance, stands on a 100-meter-high hill in Dakar. It features a 50-meter-tall bronze statue, 4 meters taller than the Statue of Liberty, depicting a man, a woman, and a child arising out of a volcano. He says it represents the cultural heritage of Africa. Some of his Muslim critics have called the design un-Islamic because it offers human forms as objects of worship. Dateline New Orleans Saints player Bobby McCray took to his Twitter account this week to talk about his arrest on drunken driving charges, but then apologized Wednesday for those comments. In postings that have since been taken down, McCray said he was trying to deal with a, quote, bogus charge of DWP, driving with pizza. He said his fiancée was feeding him pizza while he drove.
That's a good idea.
And owners of a Rapid City, South Dakota clothing store have apologized for displaying a set of offensive T-shirts portraying Native Americans as alcoholics. The owners have also promised to donate $1,000 in merchandise to a local Native American cause. Not, I hope, including those T-shirts. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Oh, that sounds like the record was queued up to the end of the song rather than the beginning. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, on your computer, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free thing for your smartphone, I think it's free, at stitcher.com. Check that out, I don't know if it's free. Available as a free download to members at audible.com/show, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like everything being free if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks, and to Miss Judith Owen. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Even in absentia. Absentia, North Carolina, I believe. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of music heard hereon, just part of the unending potpourri at your disposal at harryshearer.com. And this program is Twitterizing at LeTwits. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Here's to a new decade, everybody.